Homer is thought to have lived roughly the middle of the 9th century B.C., or let's just say about 850 B.C., to give you something to tie this to. And to put it in biblical perspective, that would make Homer about 120 years older than Isaiah the prophet. We're rounding it off and we're dealing with theology of the Old Testament predates Isaiah, going back to David and to Moses and so forth. We can go back to 1400 B.C., roughly, at the time of the Exodus, for when the Hebrews first wrote down their outlook on life, if you will, inspired by God. So I just want you to see where this ties in. It's unfortunate, we go through our educational experience and we learn about Old Testament history here and secular history here, and we don't see any tie-ins. Okay, Homer wrote the epic poem, the Iliad. The Iliad is about the Trojan War, and it's an attempt to explain the woes numerous that have come upon Greece. Why is Greece undergoing all these problems, all these woes? In general terms, Homer explains it as stemming from human pride and passion, people being governed by their passions, and especially by hubris, pride, and, this is the crucial point, from the interference of the gods. The interference of the gods. Homer is a pagan, and he teaches Greek culture that what's happening round about in large measure has to do with the interference of the divine. But there are many gods. Zeus is the present ruler over the gods, but Zeus is not anything like Jehovah, the creator of heaven and earth. In fact, Zeus himself was created. Who can help me with my Greek mythology? Where does Zeus come from?
He was
one of the time, like Cronus.
That's right. Zeus,
other standard,
arises from the god of time. So time gives rise to the gods, if we could put it in our literal or vernacular today. Isn't that amazing? The gods don't rule over time. Time gives rise to Zeus and to the other gods. But Zeus is the final authority over these lesser gods. The Greeks look upon nature in every aspect of life having its own particular god. There was a god of the sea and a god of the hills and a god of the farms and fertility, a god for the sun, and on and on and on. Zeus is the final authority over these lesser gods within their domains. But he is not omnipotent. We've already seen he's not the creator of all, and he's not eternal. Time is more basic than Zeus. He's the final authority, but he doesn't have ultimate power. Moreover, Zeus is impulsive. When you read Homer's Iliad, Zeus is harassed by his relatives, especially his wife. Or talk about reading your own experience or your own life into God. I mean, Homer looks around and he sees how women harass their husbands, and Zeus has a harassing wife, you know, and other relatives as well. And Zeus is subject to the fates, a dark and mysterious set of powers in Homer, the fates. However, when you read Homer, he doesn't quite get his theology together. I mean, he's not altogether consistent. Sometimes Zeus has to consult the scales to understand what the fates have determined. And yet at other points when you read Homer, the gods apparently can interfere with fate. It said that so and so or such and such wouldn't have happened if the gods had interfered, even though fate had determined, or fates, the fates had determined it. So it's not quite clear what his relationship is, but for the most part it appears that Zeus and the other gods are subject to fate. Not only is Zeus not omnipotent above everything else, I mean, time and fate are more basic than he is, he's not morally superior to men either. Homer portrays the king of the gods as capricious and impetuous, egotistical, selfish, dishonest. Zeus is nothing more but a human being written large. Nothing more but a man with human passions and so forth, but with a lot more power to mess around with his passions and impetuosity. Why do the Greeks worship the gods? It's very evident in Homer, and it's evident from Greek culture. The gods were not worshipped out of respect. They were not respectable. They were venial. They were vain. They quarreled with each other. They were guilty of lust and adultery and dishonesty and lies. And so they weren't worshipped out of respect. The gods were worshipped as a business transaction. The gods could be useful to you because they were more powerful. It's not that they are better, and it's not that they're all powerful, but the point is they've got more power than you do. And so people would bring their gifts to bribe the gods. Let me just say in passing, is that the Christian view of sacrifice? Do we bring a gift to God, or look at Old Testament religion, is a gift given to God to bribe him into being happy? It's like God's unhappy with us, so we'll give him a gift and that'll cheer him up. No, that is a pagan notion, that you can have a business transaction with God. You give him a gift. God says at one point in the Old Testament, Psalm 50, as I recall, if I were hungry, I wouldn't tell you. I don't need your gifts. I don't need your sacrifices. Okay? Sacrifice is made because it represents the sacrificer, and the death of the animal symbolizes the appropriate death of the sinner, because that's the price of sin. The Greeks had no concept of atonement because they had no concept of absolute morality. Furthermore, in Homer, nature is not a system of regularity and predictability. The gods are interfering with the world in which we live, and these gods conflict with each other, and they're capricious within themselves, and so irregularities are found in the natural order. Now, what is the outcome of that kind of thinking? If that's your worldview, that the irregularities, the discontinuities you find in your experience are due to the interference of the gods, who are capricious and unpredictable, then you have no motivation to explore the world and master the world as a causal order. Isn't that right? Why bother to go out and try to find out within the natural order why things happen the way they do when it's really beyond your power anyway? Who knows when these gods who are going to have arguments or are going to get into a fit or be impetuous are going to interfere. So not only is there a lack of a predictable, ordered nature to study in Homer, there's also no universal moral order, no uniformity in the moral domain. The gods issue their regulations, but the regulations of the god are just the dictates of the overlords. They have nothing to do with essential justice or goodness or love. The gods can issue these orders without rhyme or reason. There need not be a good purpose. It's not as though the gods issue these orders because they know this is what is best for mankind, what will turn out. This is just the will of the gods. And moreover, the gods deal sometimes with moral defects, but only some moral defects in Homer, like pride in particular. The gods really don't like pride. Hubris is something that's got to be dealt with. But they don't deal with other moral defects all the time. Sometimes adultery, sometimes infidelity is really bad, and other times the gods don't seem to even be aware of it. Sometimes they practice it. What kind of moral order do you get out of this? So there's the notion that the gods do look at moral issues, but not all the time and not consistently, and they themselves don't represent the moral law. And so in Homer, I think we have to conclude there is no real concept of a moral law that's binding upon all men and upon the gods. Now, of course, we wouldn't want to say as Christians that the moral law is binding upon God. We would rather say the moral law reflects the character of God. But the point is, there's no connection between the moral law and gods, or a universal obligation binding all men. The gods are capricious, and as I've already said, they themselves are immoral many times. So in Homer, we have no true concept of God's omnipotence. We have no concept of atonement. We have no incentive for science. We have no absolute morality. And finally, learning and knowledge, as you read the Iliad and the other works of the poets, learning and knowledge for the Greeks comes through mindless imitation, a monkey see, monkey do kind of approach to learning, not by learning the basic principles of things, how they work, why they work, or what they're made of, not by studying the essence of things. To put it simply, learning is by tradition, the repeating, often the ritual repeating of the tradition, the way the poets had said things, rather than by conceptual understanding, generalizing and coming to a place where you can get a formula, as it were, for what things are and how they work in this world. Now, before I go on, I've said that rather hurriedly, and I want to make sure that you know what I'm getting at. In Homer, people learn things by watching the actor and then imitating the actor, or listening to the bard and then repeating what the bard says. That's learning, imitation. Whereas I think you will all realize from your own educational career, that's not what we consider learning. We may consider that the first steps toward mental discipline, but learning is when you understand, and that means you have concepts. You see generalizations. You can think abstractly rather than just in terms of the particular. The poet is saying this, or the actor is doing that. We think of generalizations. This is an example of, and then we start looking for what distinguishes one thing from another in terms of what's essential to it over against what's essential to that. Thinking in terms of concepts is different than imitating in a ritual way the words or actions of someone else. And so what's our conclusion? We look at Homer the poet, and he was the great teacher of ancient Greece. I mean, there's nothing like the influence of Homer in our day and age that I could even give you as an analogy. All of Greece was taught by Homer. They listened to the Iliad and the Odyssey, and they would that's how they saw the world. That was kind of like the framework for everything. The conclusion that we come to is that in Homer there is no universal order that can be known by reason. There is no universal order to be known by reason. Now, if you're really alert this morning, you may be thinking back, that was one of the questions you gave us yesterday, Dr. Bonson. One of the basic questions, the enduring issues in philosophy, right? And in Homer, there is no universal objective order to be explored by man's reason. Let's move ahead 100 or more years to Hesiod, the Greek poet Hesiod. And most scholars date Hesiod in the early 700s B.C. And so I'm going to put 725. This is not an exact date any more than Homer's 850, but I just want to give you some perspective. The early 700s B.C. So this would make Hesiod a contemporary, probably, of Isaiah the prophet. Hesiod wrote a number of works, two that you might want to remember. Theogony, T-H-E-O-G-O-N-Y, Theogony, and also a social commentary, Works and Days, Works and Days. In Hesiod, we still find an anthropomorphic cosmology. We still have a view of the origin of the universe that is written as though human beings are active doing things. You have the gods and the history of the gods being parallel to what is really the history of the universe, its origin. So he's not much better than Homer cosmologically. He's just another pagan who is trying to explain the origin of the world by projecting human traits and events. However, there is a difference in Hesiod's theology, and I think it's important for us to see this. In Hesiod, now 125 years, let's say, after Homer, Zeus has become a ruler who is now just and predictable. Hesiod has a much more noble view of Zeus than did Homer. Zeus has moral integrity. In fact, Zeus is one who can be counted on to lift the downtrodden up. And Zeus has the power to enforce the rule of law. No longer do we find Zeus being quite as harassed or impetuous. Zeus can bring things about and will bring the rule of law to fulfillment. Zeus is not quite as weak and wimpish and impetuous, and you can count on Zeus for justice. Fate, or the fates, in Hesiod are no longer the wild, unpredictable force that even the gods have to look up to in Homer, but fate becomes for Hesiod. Now, I'm really mixing cultures when I say this, but I think it'll be helpful to give an analogy. Fate becomes much more like karma, than the portrayal of fate or the fates in Homer. Fate is not indifferent to human concerns. In Homer, the fates just dictate. And it's kind of like, to hell with human nature. Whatever suffering comes, who cares? But in Hesiod, it's not that way. Fate is concerned about human needs and feelings. And for him, there is a certainty and a predictability, a regularity, in the pervasive, active moral law that operates throughout nature. That's why I said it's kind of like karma. It's pervasive, it's moral, but it's active. The law is at work in the world, and it's everywhere, so that if you mistreat a poor person, it's going to come back to haunt you. Karma is going to catch up with you. It's not so much a cold, indifferent fate beyond this world, just dictating what's going to happen, but it's a fate that is part of this world, like a moral law operative in nature. Moreover, in Hesiod, we see that man is not seen as like the rest of nature. Man lives in the natural world, but he's not just natural. Man isn't just an animal. Man, in fact, should live up to his responsibilities as a man. Animals may be governed by passion and be wild and so forth, but men are not supposed to. Men are to be displaying self-control. They are to be governed by inner restraint, or the word moderation might be good here. And so in Hesiod, we now have a universal order in nature. We didn't really have that fully developed in Homer. But nature now shows an orderliness, and it's a moral order. And yet nature is not, in Hesiod, open to human reason, because he has that anthropomorphic cosmology. Nature still has, in some degree, the interference of the gods. And so human reason cannot explore and find out ultimate reality, but ultimate reality is characterized by a universal order that is moral in character. In my lecture yesterday, I told you to look for dialectical tensions. I said it will take some time, but as you look at these things, you'll more and more be able to pick out these trends. In Hesiod, do you see any kind of dialectical order or disorder, any dialectical tension? You have a pervasive moral law, right? Runs through nature. But man is not part of nature. Well, he is part of nature, but he's not part of nature. Now, how do you get this together? Man is part of this universal moral order that we call the natural world, where karma or fate is operative. And yet man has a higher calling than to act like a natural animal. Well, which is it? Man is not subject to the same generalizations and laws as animals. So he, in some sense, is not part of nature, and nor are the gods part of nature, and yet Hesiod is struggling toward an idea of a universal order in nature. Let's move ahead to the great Greek tragedian Aeschylus. Aeschylus was born roughly 525 BC, so as you can see, we're jumping ahead 200 years. Dr. Bonson's survey is not calculated to be systematic and even-handed. I want to touch some high points here. Homer, Hesiod, and now Aeschylus. Aeschylus is the Greek writer who is responsible for the trilogy, the Orestia, O-R-E-S-T-E-I-A. In the outlook of Aeschylus, religion, following of the gods and so forth, has become a benign and enlightening influence on human affairs. In Homer, we had capricious gods, unpredictability. In Hesiod, we have a more universal moral order. In Aeschylus, the gods have an enlightening and benign influence on human affairs. A good example is, as part of his trilogy, we have Orestes, O-R-E-S-T-E-S, the character, who's guilty of murdering his own mother. And the Furies are pursuing Orestes to kill him, to bring vengeance. But Apollo and Athena intervene to protect this guilty man. And according to the story, justice, which is due, I mean, this man is guilty, but justice must be tempered by mercy. This is Aeschylus' way of saying that the Furies, which represent that irrational, wild part of man's nature, must be tamed. in the story, the Furies are taken away by Athena and locked up in a cave. Man's wild side must be tamed. There must be a benign and enlightened approach to human affairs, and this is what the gods show us by intervening against the Furies. Let's move ahead a few years to about 495, which is the date assigned for the birth of Sophocles. Again, that's a date of birth, not a date of flourishing. Sophocles expresses a great serenity and confidence in his writings because, as he sees it, the world is well ordered. Every part of the world harmonizes into a perfect picture, and even the discordant and ugly parts of the world, those things which seem very unpleasant, they fit into a universal order as well. For Sophocles, man has over him a divine law to which appeal can be made. How many of you are familiar with the play Antigone? You know the story. Antigone has a relative that's been killed in war, and because the relative was defying the king, as a form of punishment and humiliation, decrees that this relative of Antigone's that has died is not to be buried. His corpse is to be left out, which is the highest form of humiliation, really, given the Greek understanding of death and so forth. And Antigone defies the king's order to obey, I don't want to overly Christianize this conception, but to obey the higher law. She does what is right in defiance. Now, she suffers for it. That's the tragedy. Here's Antigone, who's going to suffer, but she suffers what we call a righteous or a just person. And so for Sophocles, there is a divine law over all that realizes man's ideals and strivings, and against which, or to which, a person might appeal against the injustice and unrighteousness in this world. Why does tragedy come into this world? For Sophocles, it comes through man's character defects, the self-will of the king who refuses to allow Antigone, or who has forbidden Antigone or anybody to bury the corpse. That's where tragedy comes through, the defect in character, the pride, the self-will of man. So what do we see now? We've seen a development from Homer through Hesiod and Aeschylus. Now when we get to Sophocles, we have a universal order. There is a divine, well, let's call it a moral or divine law above the affairs of men. And men are, in a sense, controlling their fate. If they're guilty of moral defect, pride, and excess, and passion, then they get themselves into their own difficulties. With the coming of the Peloponnesian War, the Greek outlook changes again. And now, away from the optimism or the self-confidence of Sophocles to a much more despairing and tragic outlook. Just a word about the Peloponnesian War. The war raged for a generation, from 431 BC to 404 BC. The war was between Athens and Sparta. Athens was a commercial democracy, did a lot of trading. It had almost a town meeting democracy form of government. Any citizen of Athens could come any day that the government was open and could, you know, set things before the populace and votes could be taken and so forth. Sparta, on the other hand, was a stern and warlike oligarchy. ruled by a few wealthy and powerful people. And the cultural outlook was extremely stern. You bore children only during certain times of your life and during the year. There was an emphasis upon, if you will, soldier-like qualities, being able to take commands, being able to get by with a small amount of food and sleep, being tough, going to the gym, working out. Of course, in our day and age, that's all recreational and fun and so forth. But in that day, I mean, it was considered just part of the discipline that was necessary to be a good citizen. Well, Athens and Sparta suspected that Athens was trying to dominate everyone through their, we do know that Athens did try to play games at what we call in the market. They excluded Corinth, you know, and really brought Corinth to its knees economically through unfavorable trade practices and so forth. Sparta suspected that's what Athens wanted to do to everybody. Athens had the feeling that if Sparta or anybody else resisted their attempt to spread their goodwill, their commercial prosperity and their democratic habits, that that would be the death of Athens. And so they had this notion that one or the other had to be dominant in Greek culture. So they went to war. I mean, politicians, historians and politicians can give you a better account of the actual trigger and so forth, but from the mindset of the Athenians and the Spartans, one of them had to be dominant. However, the war didn't go well. It brought internal class tension and warfare among the Athenians. In fact, because the war went poorly, when you have a democracy, if you understand, everybody gets together and from one day to another has his own view of how the war is going and what we should do about it. I mean, democracy is horrible in time of war. Well, that's why you'll find, you study history, for the most part, even those cultures that tend toward a democratic or, let's just call it a more democratic form of government, the participation of the many in the political process will curtail that in times of emergency for the sake of being able to make efficient and consistent decisions. Athens didn't have that. And so the lower classes and the economically superior classes were very suspicious of each other. They argued with each other. They're, you know, do we continue the war? Do we not? Do we prosecute it this way? Whatever. And so this distrust destroyed the political unity of Athens. And on top of this, barbarous tactics were sometimes practiced. The Athenians sent a delegation to one of the Greek islands that had tried to remain neutral in the war and tried to persuade them to come over, you know, to Athens' side, that it was to be in their best interest to support them in the war effort. And when the policy of persuasion didn't work, the generals butchered the people. That didn't go over well. We're not in ancient Assyria now where people just say, oh my, I mean, here's this violence, I better get in line lest I be next. People have begun to think in terms of a universal moral order, and this idea of butchering, even though it would have been advantageous to the Athenians for that island to throw in their cause with them, it just kind of turned the stomachs of many people to see the barbarous tactics. And there was this internal class warfare intention anyway. About this time, a poet by the name of Aristophanes writes a number of plays that express an anti-democratic cynicism about what's going on. First of all, Aristophanes is cynical about democracy. He laughs this to scorn, seeing democracy as nothing more but demagoguery. You may all pride yourselves in that you rule the culture round about you, but you're really just the pawns of whoever stands up and offers you you know, the bribes and the demagogues and their speeches and so forth, you really aren't making intelligent decisions. You're just being pulled about by your emotions, so forth. As far as Aristophanes was concerned, the only way to get away from the veniality of the demagogues was to have a communist order, what we would call a communal order in society. The most important thing, though, is that you put down in your notes the cynicism toward democracy that Aristophanes expresses. So we go from Sophocles through the Peloponnesian War experience and Peloponnesian on the board, and the example that I gave from Aristophanes, and we end up finally in our whirlwind tour with Euripides. Euripides was born in 480 BC, so roughly 50 years before the outbreak of the Peloponnesian War. He's getting on in years. But the war brings not just cynicism to Euripides, but a real sense of despair. If you want to do some reading on your own, you should look at the plays by Euripides, Helen, Medea, or Medea, M-E-D-E-A, and the Trojan Women. Those are three separate plays. Early in the war, Euripides was very patriotic and supported the Athenian effort. But after he saw the cruelty of the war and the futility of the war, he turned against it. He believed that the moral order of nature was being violated, and that would inevitably bring destruction for everybody. But for Euripides, it isn't as though you can appeal to the gods like in Antigone or Sophocles. He explicitly says it is useless to appeal to the gods. They're helpless to improve things. On the other hand, he wasn't willing to give up the notion that there are gods. For him, a world without religion would have seemed very meaningless. And yet, it also didn't do him any good. He didn't think the gods could intervene to help. And so for Euripides, where is man in the universe? He's a passive victim. He's a passive victim. There is a moral order, but inevitably we are destroyed by it. And we would all be better off with a callous indifference to life rather than trying to hold out ideals. War had really destroyed idealism for Euripides. And so what we have in Euripides is the development of despair because the higher law has been spurned. The noble ideal of the earlier generations of an ordered world and reason, the noble ideal of order and reason, has now been destroyed by self-interest, the egoism and egotism about us, and the atrocities of war, man's passion. This is what he seems to be metaphorically or parabolically expressing in his plays. Man's self-interest and war's atrocities destroy the noble ideal of order and reason. Sophocles shows confidence and serenity about the world, Euripides despair. Ironically, even in Euripides, however, you may notice this, that salvation, man's salvation, is going to be internal. What's wrong with man? Passion is ruling over reason. Egotism is taking away a desire to help others. self-interest is interfering with doing the right thing, being just. And so man needs an internal ethical switch in order to be saved, rather than looking to God's intervention and the need for atonement and so forth. So for the Greeks, what you see is progressive development of get away from the gods and the transcendent, bring everything down to nature, and then finally into the internal nature of man. But in the process, because especially of the Peloponnesian War, that appeared to be an optimistic sort of thing, it ends up being a matter that brings despair to people, that man can't control his environment, and man's defects, his internal defects, are going to lead to destruction. All right, the poets are not the greatest of philosophers, but I think you can appreciate what the Greek philosophers, the Milesians and the Pluralists and Heraclitus and others, were trying to accomplish. And you can appreciate the direction of their thought. Again, we're moving away from any dependence upon the transcendent or the supernatural, and we want to have a natural understanding of the world and a natural morality, and everything to be, you know, in one sense, under the control of man, his way of seeing things, the way he makes decisions, and so forth. Please don't have the idea that the first of the philosophers we're going to look at after we take a break, Thales, follows Euripides in historical order. I just wanted to give you a unit on the Greek poets so you have some concept of what's happening most generally in Greek culture, the mentality of the Greek world in terms of which these philosophers worked. The date for Thales is actually about 600 B.C. People argue about when he flourished, about 580 B.C. He may have been born as early as 624 B.C. But we'll just use the figure of 600 to give us some idea of where he is. So as you can see on the board, the dates that I've given you for Homer, Hesiod, Aeschylus, and so forth, we have Thales intervening between the days of Hesiod and the days of Aeschylus as Greek poets. He's right about here between B and C on the outline. All right, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, then we'll finally start looking at the Greek philosophers themselves.